Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 11th, 1998. And in the fireside room this evening, we have a presentation by Paul Olson. It's entitled, It's Not My Fault, Adam's and Eve's Awareness, and it's about racial harmony. It's a brief look at how we read the creation story and the fall, and taking our cue from the great English poet John Milton, I think it's called, we will consider mankind's rise to consciousness, then with excerpts from African-American novelist Langston Hughes, we will consider white responsibility and racial reconciliation. And this is OLP 98-1. And now let's listen in on the discussion and lecture.
We will start. This is the literature session. It's entitled, It's Not My Fault, Adam's and Eve's Awareness, and how that might connect to racial consciousness. And I'm Paul Olson.
I thought you wanted us to introduce ourselves.
I do. Okay. And so let's just do that quickly, introduce the fans to the players and go around. And I introduce myself, so it's only fair.
Okay. I'm Rose Hamilton.
Okay. You're from where?
Yakima, Washington.
Okay. I'm Ruth Miller from Seattle, Washington.
And I'm Dorothy Griffin from Seattle, Washington.
Audrey Rasmussen, Calgary, Alberta.
Julie Tones from Worcester, Ohio.
Mal Siegman from Batavia, Illinois.
And
you're home.
From Dayton, Ohio?
No.
Steve Day from Dayton, Ohio.
Jeannie Olson, Paul's biggest fan.
Yeah, she says that now.
Dorothy Bass from Valparaiso, Indiana.
Marty Whitmore from Livingston, Montana.
Ooh. Mike Swenson, Nome, Alaska.
Dave Berger, Los Angeles.
Todd Maurice, Prince George, British Columbia.
Laurel Robinette, Holman, Washington.
Betsy Meyer, Seattle.
Come on, McDonald.
Hi, Wilma.
Is that what
you're doing? Dwayne
Brown, Waterbury Staff.
Did you really?
Joyce Lynn,
Theodore,
Arkansas. Jeff Myers, Seattle, Washington.
Manhattan, Chicago.
It's a Republic.
Esterman, Virginia.
Boy, it's fun to be holding it. People from everywhere. It's fun. Well, we're going to do two things tonight. Look at the Adam and Eve story in Genesis and consider it maybe a little differently than some of the biblical scholars do. And I'm taking my cues on how to look at that story from the great English poet John Milton. And then go to some illustrations in African American literature that might suggest to us at what point in our lives do we become responsible for our actions? And is it legitimate to hold us accountable for our actions. And I got this idea, it's stewed in me for many, many years as an African-American literature teacher. But last year at Augustana, where I teach, after showing a video, I show videos every now and then. Do you guys read the comic strip, or what takes place in the high school?
Funky Winkerbeam?
Funky Winkerbeam, did you read that? Well, they have a coach in there, and he's really not a very good educator. And when he misses a day of school, they just hire a movie projector guy to take his place. Somebody asked me once how many videos I was showing in class, and I smiled and said, I'm a coach. I can show as many as I want. I only show one. Well, after showing this wonderful video called Eyes on the Prize, a documentary of the civil rights movement in the 60s, 50s and 60s, to just introduce students to that part of, to that kind of intellectual milieu of the literature we'll be reading, I asked them to write a poem afterwards. And now these are people who are not necessarily majoring in English, and in fact most of them don't, and poetry frightens them at first. But here are four examples of that, and I'd like to connect these with what happened to these students, 20, 21, 22-year-old women and men, who became acquainted with something that they hadn't been acquainted with before. They'd heard about the civil rights movement. They'd heard about a person like, say, Emmett Till. Anybody want to tell us who he is or was? Dorothy.
Was
an African-American teenager who was lynched during a visit. He was from Chicago, went to visit the South, where some relatives were.
Yeah.
And someone thought that he looked the wrong way at a white woman. And
they killed him.
They killed him.
Yeah. Good. That's Emmett Till, and he's a famous civil rights.
He was in the 50s or 60s.
54. Yeah.
50s.
Yeah. And you're right, he's 14 years old. And they threw him in a river, and they found his body, and his mother from Chicago insisted on an open casket. And he'd been in the river for quite a while, and he'd been beaten to show what these white men had done. well, the Emmett Till episode, or the Emmett Till case, it was part of the Eyes on the Prize video. And another one was about, another part of the, to show in the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, was about Rosa Parks. And you know who she is? Somebody just tell us. Dorothy just saved you from a quiz. I had one ready to go at the end, but now she got you through it.
She drank out of the fountain.
She probably did, but she's more famous for something else.
She took a front seat in the bus. Yeah. She's a black woman.
Yeah, and didn't give it up.
Right.
And it's interesting that you remember a water fountain, but we know Rosa Parks for some kind of rebel cause against the status quo of whites and blacks in the South. Well, these students had just seen this video, and here are four of their poems, and they're very short, but I think pretty special. 4 minutes after class started, gotta have a poem. What to write? Gotta be connective. I must have told him these things, right? Gotta be connective. Ought to be common. Wish it were good. Could write about Emmett Till's mangled face, but white. But what? Could write about Rosa, why push us around Parks, but how? Could write about white women driving black women while their husbands burn crosses. Could write about workers laughing and walking 7 miles. That's a reference to the bus boycott where the black people walked to work instead of taking the buses. Could write about the confused Klansmen meeting suddenly. Strong blacks, what, no fear? But how do I help it connect with other people the way it connected with me? I'm illustrating what I mean by a rise in consciousness. I've read many history books and seen many programs. I've learned facts behind lynchings, beatings, and killings. I've seen pictures of depressed, run-down homes where people lived. I've learned about a young boy killed for saying hello, and then about the murderers who went unpunished. Yet the more I read, the more I see, and the more I learn, the less I understand. Don't ever tell anybody that teaches in college that our kids are failing us. A table set, reaping the gluttony of America, food solely for the palate to taste, the stomach to absorb, pasta and salad and wine and beer, pie for dessert, friends, I am overwhelmed with the wealth of America. As it evolves from the melting pot to the salad bowl society, inequality, injustice, and hate are the prevailing issues of our time, burning holes in the desires of its people. One questions the probability of a moment when all can free their minds. Listen and hear, remember history, cherish it, cry from it, learn from it, remember, and move on. This is by a black woman. I don't like you, and this I cannot hide, but if you ask me straight out, I might just lie. Not because I fear you, I fear not what your evil can do, but simply because, as much as I hate to admit it, I have become very much like you. Not because I fear you, for there is nothing more that you can do. Don't fear me for who I am now, but fear me as I become more and more like you. That, I think, is about the whole value system adopted by the American culture. Well, those were examples of awareness on the part of, as I said, 20 and 21-year-old students. And there's an important biblical connection, I believe. As I said earlier, I take my cue from John Milton, the author of Paradise Lost, perhaps the greatest poem in the English language. And his language for the fall of humankind, as we call it in Genesis, is, Milton says, it's the fortunate fall. Other literary critics call it man's rise, or humankind's rise to consciousness, and it perhaps isn't a fall at all. And I just glanced last night through our resource library into the section that's really on theology and biblical studies, and there are hundreds of books devoted to the study of Genesis, and you can imagine that each one of those hundreds of books touches the creation and the fall story. And my point isn't to get into the scholarship of those stories, but to look at, later on in the week, we'll look at the creation story, but tonight just at what we've long called the fall, the story of Adam and Eve. And putting aside for a moment that there's a P source and a J1 source and a J2 source and all kinds of literary criticism and connections to the Babylonian myth and all that criticism that is there and that literary historical study that is there, we still are left with a story. And a story that all of us can read without any side criticism, without any help to help us understand what it means. And if we couldn't understand it as story, then it couldn't be a very good story if we had to have help all the way through it. And that doesn't mean that the help that we get from these scholars isn't a good thing and doesn't enrich our understanding of what the story can mean, but it means that the story by itself can also just stand alone. So I'm going to read quickly parts of this very famous story that you all know so well, and we'll see what we do with it. And I guess what I'd ask you to listen for is to listen if you hear anything you hadn't heard before or hadn't thought about before. The creation has already happened, and that's a bit of a confusion too, where we have man created first and man and woman created together at the same time in one story, and then woman after man in another story. But now they're both happily bouncing around Eden, eating their pears and peaches and fish and just having a great time there. And this little snake found its way into their Eden. Now the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God say you shall not eat of any tree of the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And also she gave some to her husband, and he ate. Langston Hughes, excuse me for the interruption, has a wonderful story in The Ways of White Folks about how black culture has interpreted the story, and has said no black woman is going to give a man a bruised apple. This wouldn't happen. There would be no evil in the world, argues Langston Hughes in this comedic story. So if you want to laugh about that whole story and get some different insights, Langston Hughes's, it's the simple, I said The Ways of White Folks, it's not that, it's the simple stories. Well, she gave him the apple and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of thee in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." He said, "Who told you that you were naked?" I've always thought that was a great line in the story. I can tell, right? But you'll get it. "Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent beguiled me, and I ate." It's the classic passing of the buck, isn't it? The Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all cattle." And then we'll go through about six verses of curses, and you probably know those well, but I'm going to pay more attention to the ending and the resolution of this part of the story. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life." Anybody hear anything that they hadn't heard before or thought about before? You're all biblical scholars, so I've thought of all that before, you could say. Is there anything interesting about the story that just strikes you as, like it struck me? Gee, who told you you were naked? I don't need to be told, I can tell. Just anything out of the story, just as we have it. And if you can, maybe put aside the sermons you've heard, the studies you've perhaps made of that story, and just listen to what you heard.
The God being plural, that one reference, and they saw, that always kind of strikes me. I wonder what they're, exactly what that means.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question, and I'm not going to answer. But pardon me?
I don't have the answer either. Don't let me.
Well, there are some answers to that, and one of them is that it's the King James translation, and not only a history of English in the 15th century to use the so-called kingly we, but also that's a Hebrew tradition as well.
Because it happens other times in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
Who is that they referring to? God? I thought it was Adam and Eve. They themselves saw that they themselves were.
I was referring to the end of the story.
Oh.
Where the end of the story, when the gods talked to decide what they were going to do.
Yeah. Anything else? Good.
I would like to know what nakedness fully entails. I mean, it's more than just not having clothes.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, because it's a tree of knowledge, not the tree of bare flesh. There's more involved in that. It's an awareness of shame, guilt.
So naked equals something more than just... So already, and that's what we're going to find out, of course, we're seeing something in the story. This story, we have no helps for ourselves, but we're saying there's got to be something more here. I mean, naked isn't, it's too obvious, right? So we ask the question, and it's a great question, what does this mean? It's not the tree of bare flesh, it's the tree of knowledge. That's a great response. Anybody want to develop that or add to it? Or?
Well, we've seen that nakedness is okay in and of itself, but having some kind of knowledge that they gained from having eaten the fruit would indicate to them that nakedness represented something sinful or bad or wrong, whatever.
The nakedness might be sinful. What is it that, and that's a great observation too, and I think I'll help you out with how to read, or how to get started on things that are difficult in literature, is the first thing that you ask is, the second thing, as you ask these questions, ask yourself, how does it fit in the whole story? And what kind of sense does it make in the whole story? And we ask other questions about this. Is it that they are naked, that they have no clothes? Is that what God is disturbed about? Or, I mean, they've been naked all along, and now they... Who's disturbed? Is it God or...
No.
They are. And God then says what? Who told you were naked? How do you know that? And I'll give you an analogy that I borrowed from C.S. Lewis in a different context, is a fish doesn't know what wet is. I mean, because it's wet all the time, so it doesn't know dry or wet. And these folks didn't know what naked was until they know something else now. And that's, right, what is nakedness? So that you raised a great question and a great insight to what's happening here. Anything else?
It's so sad when he says, I heard you and I was afraid, because prior to that, we don't really know what the relationship was, but it probably didn't involve fear.
Yeah. Wow. The folks here, we write that over here, Adam and Eve are afraid. And before, we don't know what they were before, but clearly that's never mentioned, that they were afraid. And as you said, we don't know what that relationship was, but it's already been complicated. Before it was pretty much, what? Do what I say. No? Don't eat of the fruit. Okay, I won't. Until this serpent, that later lost his legs and becomes a snake, comes into the picture. So fear is added to that relationship. That's very good. Anything else?
One thing I noticed for the first time on this hearing was they're not supposed to eat because then they would be like God and have the knowledge of good and evil.
Yep.
And then Eve looks at the tree. She sees that it's pleasing. She sees that it's tasty. She sees, in other words, she already has a knowledge of good. Mm. Potentially.
She makes the judgment about it right away, doesn't she?
She has a knowledge of good. She just doesn't have a knowledge of the evil. And so now she has knowledge of the evil. And that's when she starts saying, No, but she had the knowledge to say that was a good tree. You know, that tree
yeah.
is
Yeah, it looks old. Good. Yeah.
So, yes, she has
yeah.
some knowledge.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. We're rolling, folks.
But until, I mean, the tree was there all the time, and she could have observed it all the time, but until her encounter with a serpent, that didn't happen.
Yeah. The serpent who told her God is a liar. If we eat of that, we'll die. You're not going to die, says the serpent. Oh, really? I mean, she's pretty quick to believe him, too.
Because she doesn't have knowledge of evil yet.
Right. Okay, this is really good.
I was puzzled why God asked them where they were when he very well knew where they were, if they knew where they were.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question, too, is in this story, is God just setting them up? Where were you? I mean, just to force Adam to say something, or doesn't he really know?
Just kind of asking, like, did you do this, you know, like,
yeah.
you know.
For your kids,
you
right? Yeah. Did you break this window? No. As our son used to say, he's now 22, it's David who broke the window. Dad, look at that bird out there. Anything to distract me to not ask the question anymore. Anything else? Tom?
Is there an implication that knowledge is evil?
Well, that's a good question. It's a great question, and it's a fair one, that knowledge is evil. What in the story might help you answer that? My clue for that might be to look at the ending. They now know good and evil. We could spend all night on the story, and we won't, because there's something else to lift out of this. I mean, another kind of connection to make that's contemporary.
Will you read the last sentence again?
Sure.
Because that was the thing that really struck me.
Isn't that interesting how many times you've read this, and now all of a sudden it strikes you? I mean, I'm the same way. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and the flaming sword, which turned every way, to guard the way to the tree of life. If you mapped it out, here's this Eden, and this place, and they are kicked out, my great drawings, and God puts this flaming sword, or the flame of the sword, say some biblical scholars, it doesn't matter, and they've got the guard against this, they can't go back. And you know the story, they're not left unprotected, and God clothes them and clothes them. But is that what you're getting at? That's the last line. He put a flaming sword and a cherubim to guard the way back to Eden. And I'm saying that's the ending, you asked that, and I'm asking you to make that connection between, does that say anything about the relationship of good and evil, to knowledge? They are now knowledgeable. They know good and evil. And God has stopped them from going to the place where they didn't know good and evil. Thus, John Milton.
They have to deal with what they created. There's no turning back.
There's no turning back.
Once they disobeyed God, there's no turning back.
There's a what?
Once they disobeyed God, there's no turning back.
Yeah, there's good. There's no turning back. But they don't put up this cherubim and this flaming sword. God does. In this story, God puts this block and says, you're not going back. Yes.
But there was that other tree, the tree of life, and in that one verse, it sounded like he didn't want them to taste of the tree of life too, because then they'd be just like God.
Right. That's clearly explained in there. That's right. They're not going to go back. Lest they go back and eat of the tree of life and live forever, I'm going to stop that.
So that's a different tree than the tree?
Different tree.
So somehow.
Do you guys know about the maple tree there? If you grew up in Minnesota, there are three trees in Eden, but I won't get into that. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. So where are we with that then?
Well, he wanted to stop them from getting in there and eating of the tree of life so that they would live forever. It sounded like to me in that one verse you read.
So, well, it sounded that way to me too. Now we've got two people outside of Eden, this place where they never die, and they're going to die, but Satan said, no, you will not die, and they don't die, but they're going to. Who's right, Satan or God?
Well, it was the live forever part that...
That's what it says there, but yeah, good.
Was it God's intention that humanity live forever? Was that God's original intention?
is the best comment to make to most parts of literature.
When I heard Tree of Life at the end, I thought it was I wasn't connecting it with with the story. I was connecting with Christ and salvation. Mm-hmm. See, I thought it was pointing ahead to what would rectify all this and open heaven again.
And there, and that's a good point. And there are surely biblical scholars and biblical readers who do that. That surely brings another context that imposes it on a story that was written long before anybody thought about Christ. But that's a legitimate thing to do with it too, sure.
I mean, we can do that.
We can do that, sure. Mm-hmm. But it's and lots of people, great scholars, do.
It's very merciful and loving of God to block that being able to go back into Eden under living forever under those curses.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why would we want to do that?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Because I didn't pick up on that. I picked up almost on the opposite, that it, unless I'm missing something, I didn't pick up on a very compassionate or forgiving God. It's like, you blow it once, you're out of here. See ya.
Yeah. Well, that's the legitimate observation. And if I had read farther, you would remember that right. They are clothed by God and that there is some, he doesn't just let them wander in the wilderness, you know, naked. He gives, and he apparently didn't like the clothes that they had made. And I think that's significant. And he makes his own and says, here, I'm going to get you a little better clothes. Right? What?
God the fashion designer.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he didn't mess around with his G-strings. That's all they had. Well, let's move on. And I just hope that what we've done is open some doors to the ambiguous and the provocative nature of this story. And some of the things that you can say about that are true about this story, you have already said. And I think as a student of literature, one of the things that I noticed that people do with, all readers do with these kinds of stories, is that they pull out the facts. And I love the line from The Man of La Mancha where Don Quixote says to his sidekick, facts are the greatest enemy of truth. And the facts of the story and the facts of the creation story, which we'll be looking at later in the week, are different from some of the truths that are there. And one of the truths that is here, apparently, is that God said, you can't go back. And that something, and one of the other truths is that something did die. And we know that what died is their innocence. And my analogy, pulling out of this wonderful story that is so complex and so contradictory and ambiguous and therefore so much like life, has a lot to do with how we perceive our world today too, and it has a lot to do with all literature, and it serves as a fundamental theme that runs through lots of great literature, and that is this loss of innocence. And when one loses one's innocence, is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? And in the story, it is surely a legitimate view to say God does not want them back there in that Edenic state where there is innocence and there is no awareness of good and evil. Just like probably we don't, if we're socially conscious at all, want our students to be unconscious and ignorant and unaware of what they became aware of by looking at that video. Does that seem to make a connection that's legitimate for you? Go ahead, now.
Just sort of an aside, a connection. As you intone the words of the serpent, you're not going to die. It's just so parallel to the temptation today faced by people to addictive or harmful drugs. People tell them that can kill you, and the tempter says,
yeah.
You can do that. You're not going to die. Look at all these people have done. They didn't die.
Very good.
It's just
we have riverboat gambling where we live, and it hasn't killed anybody yet, but it's killed, and my wife knows them well, it's killed some important relationships. It's killed a whole lot of things that don't mean physical death. Well, you get the sense of where John Milton is coming from in Paradise Lost, that this is the fortunate fall. It's a good thing. And as he paints Adam and Eve in their picture, the only time they are holding hands with any kind of love between them is at the end of this, at the end of this long poem, where love can really happen. And we don't have a couple of robots or automatons living and obeying God. Just this is what you do no matter what. And it's the other literary phrase is their rise to consciousness, and they are aware of good and evil. And God says, right. And now you can't go back to that stage. One of the things I would suggest to you that's a helpful and a meaningful way to look at lots of the stories in the Bible is to see them as stories that say more than their historical record might indicate, or more than even one specific interpretation might mean. That is, there are lots of ways to look at this, and we know, and we've heard sermons on it, and we read criticism on it, that this is a story about humankind and sin. And it is, and that's a legitimate and healthy and good way to look at it. So is it a story about the human journey, the journey that all people take from innocence into a world of consciousness and awareness, or from unconsciousness to consciousness. And only when one is conscious, can then we make decisions that are mature, can then we engage in love, can then we get to the kind of relationships that are more than just this, I'm afraid of you and oh my gosh, as you pointed out, that we see that relationship break down in the story. So we have that journey. There's, in African American literature, there's a story, there are lots of stories, and lots of it is about this. And knowing that I would probably speak to an all-white audience at Holden, I brought with me some examples in the literature by African Americans of the role of whites that is often inadvertent in being racist, both in their attitudes and in their actions, and also by participating in institutions that are racist, because for the most part we live in our Eden, or we live in our unconsciousness. And let me illustrate that by reading two scenes from Langston Hughes's, the more noted for his poetry than for his one very good novel, Not Without Laughter. Not Without Laughter is the story, the growing up story. It's the Catcher in the Rye it's the Huckleberry Finn. It's the Tom Sawyer. It's a young boy coming of age in white America, a young black boy, and his name is James Rogers. And you'll need to know that as you hear one of the excerpts or one of the episodes. And everybody calls him Sandy. And Sandy is 10 years old. And in this scene, he's come to an integrated classroom for the first time in his life in the fifth grade. And the scene goes like this. "Take seats, all of you now, please," she rasped out. "Anywhere now, so we can get order," she rapped again patiently with her ruler. "Take seats at once." So the children each selected a desk and sat down. Then the teacher passed out slips of paper to each child, so every student received one slip. "Now," she said, "write your name on the paper. Nothing but your name, that's all I want today." Amid much confusion and borrowing of pencils, the slips were finally signed and collected then by the teacher. Then she went to her desk to sort them, and finally she finished. "Now," she said, "each child rise as I call out your name so I can see who you are. Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich, Josephine Evans," she called slowly, glancing up after each name. "Franklin Rhodes, James Rogers," that's our protagonist, our hero, Sandy. Sandy stood up quickly. The roll call continued, each child standing until he had been identified and then sitting down again. "Now," the teacher said, "everybody rise and make a line around the wall. As I call your names this time, take seats in order, starting with number one in the first row near the window." "Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich," the roll was repeated, each child taking his seat as she had commanded. When all but four of the children were seated, the two colored girls and Sandy still were standing. "Albert Zwick," she said, and the last white child sat down in his place. "Now, you three colored children, take the seats behind Albert. You girls, take the first two, and you," pointing to Sandy, "take the last one. Now, I'm going to put on the board the list of books I want you to buy," and the scene ends there. What do you make of that? Much of it is obvious. But what did you notice about this calloused teacher? And I would appreciate it if you state the
obvious. She had no hesitancy in her decision.
No, great point. No hesitancy at all. This is the right thing to do. This is the way it's done. Good, very good. Anything else?
She didn't even call the black children by name.
Didn't even call them by name. And you, pointing to Sandy, sit back there. Good. Well, we don't know for sure, but we can guess with just with American under starting American education, how old is she, the teacher? We don't know. So just guess.
40.
Huh?
40.
40. Thank you. She's 40 or so. It's obviously not her first year of teaching. Okay. That's scene one in Not Without, it's not scene one, just scene one that I'm going to deliver to you, in Not Without Laughter. The next scene occurs when Sandy, not that I want to draw on, Sandy and his two friends, Earl, who is white, and Willie Mae, who is a girl and is black, have been cutting coupons out of a local newspaper for 2 weeks. Every day, and they go down the streets and they borrow newspapers from friends and neighbors and cut out these coupons so that they can get into the new show that's coming to town with its Ferris wheels and shoot the chutes and lemonade and merry-go-rounds and all kinds of things that a carnival like would have. And note that, I mean, if you were reading the novel, you would see how the enthusiasm and the excitement have built up over these weeks as they're cutting their coupons out and they're saving them. And on that last day, the day of the carnival, they don't call it a carnival here, the day of the fair, Willie Mae puts on her brand new shoes and her best clothes, and that's how, just to emphasize how excited these kids are. Aunt Hagar, who it refers to in the first line, is actually Sandy's grandmother with whom he lives, and she speaks to him. "Here," called Aunt Hagar, "ain't you going to take your coupons?" In his rush to get away, Sandy was so excited he'd forgotten them. It was a long walk, and this next kind of narrative stuff is about their excitement and what they were willing to do besides cut out coupons for 2 weeks. It was a long walk to the park, and Willie Mae stopped and took off her new shoes and stockings and carried them in her hand until she got near the gate, and then she put them back on again and limped bravely along, clutching her precious bits of newspaper, the coupons. They could hear the band playing and children shouting and squealing as the cars and the shoot-the-shoots shot down with a splash into the pond. They could see the giant Ferris wheel, larger even than the one the carnival had, circling high in the air. "I'm going to ride on that first," said Sandy. There were crowds of children under the bright red and white wooden shelter at the park. They were lining up at the gate, laughing, merry, clean little white children, pushing and yelling and giggling amiably, black children. Sandy let Willie Mae go first, and he got in line behind her. The band was playing gaily inside. They were almost to the entrance now. There were just two boys in front of them. Willie Mae held out her black little hand, clutching the coupons. They moved forward. The man looked down. "Sorry," he said, not unkindly. "This party's for white kids." End of the scene, almost. There's a complication that Langston Hughes adds, but once again, it's clear what's going on, right? And what would you say about what has happened?
Breaks your heart. Plan, cut out all those coupons.
And that's a wonderful phrase, it breaks your heart. And one of the arguments that what makes literature, some literature good and some literature bad, that makes it good is that we experience something ourselves as readers that we hadn't experienced before. And we have identified with Sandy's efforts, maybe not with Sandy, but if not, and if we have identified with his efforts, and we've also learned in this short time, just think of what would happen if you read the whole book, in this short time in this class, we've maybe not identified, but learned to care about this little kid. So something has happened to us already that didn't exist before, and that is this caring that we have for a character we never knew. Well, there's a complication to this scene that Langston Hughes puts in that makes it even greater and that makes me want to connect it to all that you've already talked about. The kids, one of the little girls walks away and says, "Those sons of biscuit eaters," and that's all you could say in a novel in 1934. A novel written in 1990 would have been more aggressive, I guess. And one kid says, "Sons of biscuit eaters," somebody says, "I'm going to tell my daddy," and when the person says that, Cindy says, "Yeah, sure." Knowing that that's not going to do any good to go home and tell daddy. We could, but not a black kid. Well, then Earl, their little white friend, who they've, in throughout the novel, it's clear that they are good friends and they've played together a lot. Earl comes up and speaks. "What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in?" Earl demands that, looking at his friend's worried face. "Did Willie Mae hurt her foot?" "No," said Sandy. "We just ain't going in." Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you can get more lemonade, so you take them. The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly for a moment, wondering what to say to his brown friend, and then went on into the park. Talk about that part of the scene. What's the matter? Aren't you going in? No. What do you sense there?
He doesn't see the difference. They've become such good friends that the little white boy doesn't see why, what would they be trouble? Why can't his other friends get in?
Yeah,
they're still that innocence.
Right.
Willie or Earl, whatever you call him, has that innocence about him.
Earl has no idea. And does Sandy tell him?
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, why do we think? We don't really know, and we never know in the novel at all. That's the whole scene.
Do you think they're shamed by the guy doing that?
Sure, they sure could be. I mean, this party's for white kids. That's Martin Luther King often uses that kind of reference and says that builds shame in a kid's eyes. So they sure could be that. Good. Anything else?
Where would he begin to fight it?
Where would he begin to fight it or to explain it? Right. How can Sandy explain? You know, this guy is a racist bastard. Oops, I don't know what that. I mean, he doesn't grasp that at all. He's just been to a school. He's felt it. He felt it at school, but he doesn't understand racism, whether it's institutional or attitudinal. It's beyond him. So no, we ain't going in. Good. Anything else? What about Earl?
He ends up going.
He goes. Oh, thank you. He didn't say that. He just stood, dumbly for a moment, not knowing what to say to his brown friend. Then?
Didn't ask why.
Went on into the park.
Well, that's pretty cheap.
Well, I mean.
How old is he?
15.
You do know this, but because I told you.
10.
There's a clue.
10.
he's 10. What is he? Earl, too? Your word.
I mean, he was innocent. My last word, yeah, he's innocent. And what else could he do?
Earl, too.
Well, he could stay back with his friend.
He could have.
If my friends can't go in, and are not going in, I'm not going to go.
But if he doesn't understand why they couldn't get in the first place, why would he want to stay back? He doesn't understand. Oh, okay, you guys made a choice. You don't have to go in. Well, I'm going to go. I don't think he realizes that there was anything wrong.
Yeah, does he know that he can't go?
Or the need, he doesn't realize that there's a need to stay out.
Oh.
That's his innocence. He doesn't realize why he should have stayed out.
He doesn't realize that they have not been allowed to go in, see, and they haven't told him.
This is probably standard procedure.
And that's another great statement about it. Just as it was in the school system, this is standard procedure. This is the status quo.
There's some clues, though. The white characters, the adult white characters, know that it's wrong. Okay, the guy who says you can't come in is kindly about it.
Yep.
Because he's ashamed of it. And the paper does not put in on the coupons white children only.
Yep.
Because they'd be ashamed of that, too.
And they would know that.
So somehow between Earl's age 10 and however old those people are, something is going to happen where they become conscious, but it doesn't mean they do the right thing.
Great. Great. They said, or you said, the teacher was 40. How old's the gatekeeper? We don't know. Again, give him an age.
He could be 30.
30, okay.
Or 50, 60.
Yeah.
Okay.
Older.
50, 60, is that older than 30? Yes. I look at my legs, yes. They aren't 30 anymore.
But if it's a carnival kid, he could be 20 years old.
He could be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Dorothy pointed out, he says, the Langston Hughes, the black writer who created this episode, says, he said not unkindly, sorry. It's not like, get out of here, you bunch of little brats. It's, sorry, this party's for white kids. Talk about that. That is no small thing. When we talk about, I mean, we have a lot going on here, and one of the things that's clear that you've brought up already is innocence, and I've written the word, or the number 10 and the number 40 and 30, and the great question that comes from this is at what point are we responsible to have the kind of insight that these kids had at 20? And do we, is there any of us that doesn't forgive Earl for his innocence? That doesn't say, sure, I understand why you did. If you're not going in, I'm not going in. We would do that. We're 25.
You know,
I was laughing at that, Tom.
We might not do that.
And we might not. That's a great point, too.
I mean, we just might not. When we moved to Alabama in 1960, whatever it was, 63, there was still colored fountains and
sure,
colored
sure.
bathrooms and colored doors to go into the liquor store and white. You know, and we went through the white doors. We didn't do, and I was more than 25.
Yeah. That's an honest historical assessment of our participation in institutions that are racist.
When Ari, not unkindly, he's someone who knows, has the knowledge of good and evil.
He must, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. But.
He doesn't do anything about it, but
yeah.
He knows, he registered that.
He does register it, and Dorothy said that it hints at the book that the teacher knew too. Yes.
There was almost a feeling I had of the colored boy's innocence too. Like he didn't want to say to his white friend, "Well, your people won't let me in. That's why I'm not going in." He didn't want to say that. Or mm-hmm. It's like he was being protective in a way of hurting his friend's feelings.
That's a legitimate interpretation of that scene because we know the two are, from the whole novel, you know the two are friends and that Sandy always treats him kindly. He wouldn't turn on him now. Sure.
Sandy wants to preserve Earl's innocence as long as he can.
Yeah. Because Sandy's is surely gone. I mean, this is the second time, actually in the book it's about the fourth, but for our experiences here, this is the second time it's been made real clear in his life that he's black. I'd like to have you do a little exercise, just on scratch paper or something. If you don't have scratch paper, write it on your arm. or just remember these things. I'd like to have you think of five adjectives or nouns. And those of you who are weak on grammar, that means that describe yourself. For instance, if I'm going to describe me to you, I'm going to say, I'm a teacher, I'm a father, I'm a runner, well, I'm a jogger, well, I'm a walker. It gets slower as the years go by. Just think of five, or write them down if you have a free piece of paper there. Five words only, that describe, adjectives or nouns that describe yourself. I'll give you 35 seconds. I'll be your recording secretary, too. Anybody that wants to share what some of those are, what are they? For instance, I said runner. Words that describe us. What else you got?
Grandfather.
Okay.
Mother.
Christian.
Widow.
Widow.
Dad.
I am the human to my cat. The
human.
Cat rules and breaks, so I am the cat's human.
In our house, the cat is the human, I think. Okay. Good. Anybody have anything different?
Comedian.
Communion?
Comedian?
Comedian.
I get another adjective and I just say compassionate.
That's good. We want adjectives too. Compassionate.
Teacher there.
Teacher.
Writer.
Writer. Good. Jeez. Anybody have anything different in year five?
Sure. Dual citizen.
Dual citizen. That's different. Tom's a Canadian, too. Anybody top that one?
That means you could double the houses from the government.
True.
Retired.
We know. Okay, that's those are good. What in 5 minutes now? What would you say about the words that you selected? That's an abstract and it may be a bad question, but I'm going to leave it. Then it's open to whatever you do with it.
It's so limiting.
Yeah, I mean, because all, I mean, nobody is just retired, right? And nobody is just a, well, maybe you are, no. Dave is just a comedian. Okay, nobody is just any of these things. That's great.
They're
what else?
Most of them are relational. Describes who
yeah, that's interesting
are
too.
In their role. In means of other people.
Teacher, writer, yeah.
Why it tells a status.
Good, what?
It tells a status.
And it's the status, relational, oh, you guys are great. What else?
But what whoever said earlier was important, that it's just sort of one facet, and that one facet is just a tiny portion of the whole.
Yeah. Portion, all of these are my great diagram here. I do this in my African American literature class at Augustana every year. And you run true to form. Not one of you said white. Every single black student I've ever had has written black. And look at the criteria that you've decided afterwards that you used to pick out the words that you picked. They are relational, I'm black. They are my status, I am black. They are a part of me, but a big part of you. I mean, your dadhood is a big part of who you are, and the things that you put down are clearly important things in your life. They're a part of your, not only status, but your identity, and all these black kids put down black. Where do they fit in this role of Adam and Eve and Eden and innocence and that movement out toward awareness and consciousness? And similarly, as white people encounter African American literature and encounter via the vicarious experiences of others, in our own vicarious experiences, where do we stand in the things that we ultimately can list about ourselves that we're aware of? I've been to South Africa. You've been to places, maybe some of you have been, where you have been a minority. And unless you have been, we have no reason to be conscious of our color of our skin. Most men in this room have no reason to be conscious that they are male. But most female have lots of reasons to be conscious that they are females. Whether it's walking alone down the street at night, going down to the bank to get a loan, or applying for a job at a college in a college situation. There's a consciousness, and there's a rise to consciousness that then makes us, your phrase too, aware of, that's what God said, right? That they're aware of good and evil. And now that those, and I think this is what all literature brings out of us, is that once we are acquainted, as these four kids are, and there were 30 others too, are acquainted with something they'd never been acquainted with before, what are they going to do about that? And is there a responsibility that goes along with knowledge? In my own sense of what Holden is this summer, what I've read about it becoming, and the two themes that run through this, practicing our faith and guide our feet, has something to do with, has everything to do with, okay, we're not in Eden anymore, now what? Yes?
When you say every black student you ever had puts down black, but if you were a black teacher in the south side of Chicago and you had a class of black people and you asked them to do this, I can't imagine that every black student in that environment would put black down.
I don't know, but I would guess they would. I don't know, though. And I'll tell you why I guess that. I guess that on the basis of Richard Wright's novel, Native Son, and I guess that on the basis of Ann Petrie's novel, The Street of Life for a Black Person in the City. Even when, there isn't a white character in the whole book in Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, and it's clear that they are an oppressed people, in spite of their vivaciousness and zest for life. I mean, so I don't know how, you might be right, I don't know. And I'm also, I have to be honest, of course, I'm always being honest, I'm stretching when I say every single, but it's way up there, 99 out of 100, I'm sure. Anything else?
What brings to my mind is that if I am different, like in a minority, like when we lived in Wales, probably one of the five words I would have put up there was American. because I was in the minority, you know, I was, and that was something that, that separated me from or distinguished me from, I don't know. You know, so I mean, it really makes sense why they would.
Are you reminded when you were in Wales every day that of some way or another that you were an American?
Yes.
And that's exactly the point. That's very good. Sandy's reminded that he's black. He can't get into the.
I think it came out of Arthur Ashe's autobiography, and he talked when you mentioned about, you know, almost every black student would put up their black. He talked a little bit about how when in his travels and talking to other black people, how any group that he was with or any room that he would come into. And he shared this with other African American individuals. They had a similar experience where they were in the habit of always counting how many other African Americans were in the room with them. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's a great reference. How many of you are teachers?
Retired.
Just pay attention to, or if you're not a teacher, but any class you go to, adult ed at your church or anything, and you probably won't have any black people. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of black Luthers, do we? But those of you who are teachers, just notice when you have that one or two black kid in your class, how they look around the room on the first day, how they assess the class, and the consciousness, no matter how bright they are, no matter the pre-med kid that's got a 4.0, the captain of our track team did that, 4-point black kid going to Harvard. I had him in class and he walked in. He just checked it out. I mean, he talked to me. I knew him very well. Talked to me about that. And this is an African American literature class. He wasn't the only one. Just check it out. The kid is. It's a consciousness that we don't have as white people.
I think that consciousness isn't the same as the one if you go to Wales or if you go to Japan.
Yes, that's good.
Because we don't come from a background where we're considered inferior or oppressed, or we feel oppressed or what have you. It's a very different context, even if you're the single person in the group.
That's
of a different race.
Yeah. It's a wonderful point, and I suspect that the forum tonight on the spread of the English language will suggest something like that, that we can spread the English language not with trepidation and fear, but with power and money and resources that America has. And with arrogance, and you can add all kinds of other kind of words to it, too.
Yeah, the other thing, I guess, that goes kind of with that, that was an interesting experience. When I was in graduate school, I was in the South, I was at, my master's degree was at the University of Georgia, and I did my field placement at Grady Memorial Hospital, which is the county hospital for Atlanta. And there were 33 social workers on staff, and there were 32 of them that were black, and I was the only white male. And it was a very interesting experience to be on that staff, being such a minority. But the thing that was interesting is that, you know, I could immerse myself in that world and get a sensitivity of, okay, what must be like to be a minority. But I could always leave that setting and go to a different part of Atlanta.
Yep. You can walk away. Very good point. Wow, what a class. English 3, 28 at Augustana has got openings. I'll take all of you. Anybody else? Yes.
I would just like to add that the process of recognizing, like the gatekeeper in your story did, that he is part of the privilege, that he is part of a system that privileges some people over others. The process of not only recognizing that, but refusing to buy into it anymore is very painful.
Yeah.
And I don't see it as necessarily unethical that people choose to stay in a white world or choose to stay in Eden, to use your metaphor. But there is something wrong about it. There's something wrong about Holden Village being this white. I'm just going to say that now.
Yeah. Well, there's two kinds of racism. I mean, if we want to simplify, institutional and attitudinal. And they overlap and they intermingle, and that one is a part of the other and one fosters the other, and they're inseparable, and our consciousness isn't enough.
Well, I was just going to say that last year, Martin and Bill Grace and Marcello, any of you who've been here the last several years know Marcello from Chile, and I talked about having a week. Maybe it'll happen next year, because Bill Grace will probably come back next year. That is for
African-American people. We talked at length about that. So I hope it happens sometime. And who would be good people as resource people for that?
Just an historical note, in 1987, Holden had the Rainbow on the Mountaintop. And one of the things that we found, and I'm sure Dorothy senses this at Valpo, and anybody that's in a college setting, that you pay an economic price that's very high to get black people to come. I mean, you don't get James Cone out here for nothing. You can get me for nothing, because there's lots of me's. James Cone is a black theologian who has been to Holden. And that Rainbow on the Mountaintop experience, Rainbow on the Mountain, you could talk to a camp director like Elmer Whitta was at that time, would have a better assessment of this, but it was great that year, but I know they spent a lot of money to bring people in to do that, and that's part of the issue. As it is, it costs a lot to get an English teacher to come to Augustana and teach. It costs more to get them than it does to get me.
Well, and the important point about that too is that it wasn't for those African American and other
that's a good point.
Other people. It was for us. We could all be enriched by each other. It wasn't a time for African American people.
Good.
I grew up in a very Lutheran household and family tradition and all that. One of the things that really drove me from that tradition, I think, has been the very sort of insular ethnic unit that Lutherans are generally, either German or Scandinavian. And it's really interesting for me to come back to this community here because of family. And now I work in a very multi-ethnic situation, you know, in a trilingual office and very multiracial. And for me to come here, it's really interesting because it's like stepping into a cultural microcosm.
Yes.
And it's interesting. I mean, I hear my mom saying, wow, isn't it amazing? Everybody's from everywhere. And, you know, it doesn't strike me that way. Yeah, they're from Minnesota and they're from Seattle, but they all have the same last names and what I'm realizing is that she sees something very different than I see. And for her, it is a very wide open kind of world, but they're really the same folks. You know, we all had the same grandparents, the same the same old country histories, whether it's Germany, whatever. And unfortunately, I think for all the lip service our religious institutions give to inclusion and fairness and race, even-handedness, we are the most segregated institutions in American life. And I guess I'd agree that I would like to see all religious institutions take a real hard look at that. Because I think in my mind there are two levels of racism. One is the overt, it's really easy to see. You know, we all know what it is. But then there's a second level that looks right through the other, the so-called other, and the other might be a Swede, it might be an Italian, it might be a black person, whatever, and they just kind of see them and just talk right through them and don't invite them, or maybe invite them but not expect them to come, and that's just projected in a very subconscious way, I guess that's something that does not endear me to our own Lutheran community. Or I should say your Lutheran community. I mean, I love being here and it's fun, but that's something that keeps me away.
Anybody here from Portland? the Lutheran magazine featured in the center a black Lutheran pastor. Somebody help his name, he's Bennett Holden. This was 1993, I think, and he had a street mission. And he worked at Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland. And he couldn't get funding for his church from his church or from the greater church. Yet they were featured as this mission church. You know, working out he had black kids that he was getting off the streets. He'd go out and play basketball with them for 3 days, and then they'd show up with his clerical collar. And they'd say, "You a pastor?" Yep. But he had earned the right to be heard, as my wife says about young life leaders. Anyway, he got no funding from the national or even his local church. That was the same year that thousands of kids went to Texas and got all kinds of funding. And I'm just illustrating what that guy experienced. I wish I could remember his name. Does anybody hear them besides me? He was associate pastor, Lutheran, educated at the seminary in St. Louis yet. anyway. Anybody else? Adam and Eve have raised questions, haven't they?
Yeah, the other thing that was interesting, when I was back in the field placement doing my graduate studies in Atlanta, in that hospital, I remember talking to some of the other Black social workers about racism. I remember some of them said to me, which struck me, it's kind of interesting, is they said they would much rather live in the South than live in the North. And they said, why? Why is that? And they said, in the South, with the racism, of course they're doing the generalizations, but they were saying that you knew where you stood.
Yeah.
And he said in the North, it's so much more subtle.
The overt racism that you...
Yeah.
There isn't anybody that's an English teacher that hasn't had, if they've been honest to themselves, hasn't had to deal with the canon. You know, what do we teach? We teach, you know, Faulkner and Frost and Hemingway and white men. Mm-hmm. The joke goes as, you know, white dead males. But not because... that's somebody sat around and chosen. I mean, some people have. Mortimer Adler, for one. But some people have, most of us as teachers, don't sit down and choose our curriculum. It's what's always been done. I know Hemingway, so I'm going to teach Hemingway. And I've never even heard of Richard Wright, so I'm not going to teach him. And that perpetuates, that's institutional racism. And it's so deeply embedded, it's not a part of someone's conscious thought, which is what Adam and Eve, the story, is about. We become conscious of that. And then, how do we practice our faith? And what sad commentary is we lead? And that we feel compelled to. Well, you are a wonderful class. You come to Augustine anytime you want. Thank you.